We've come to the protection called Angulimala Dharaita. Angulimala was formerly a bandit or a robber, and then he was trained by the Buddha. So history can be read in the discourse called Angulimala Sutta in the collection of middle-length discourses. The Parita in this collection is taken from that discourse. Now, Angulimala was the son of the chaplain of the king of Savatthi, King Kosala. He was sent to get education to a teacher in what is called Takkasila, a university city. And he was a good student, and so he was left by the teacher. But other students got jealous of him, and so they lied to the teacher that he was having an affair with the teacher's wife. First, the teacher did not believe them, but when they told him again and again, and the teacher believed them, and so he thought of a way of getting rid of killing his own pupil. So it is not proper for a teacher to kill his own pupil, and so he thought of a name. And that is, he called Angulimala and told him that as a fee for his education, he must give him, the student must give the teacher 1,000 fingers. It's very strange that the teacher asked for honorarium, the 1,000 fingers to the right hand. Then he was not yet known as Angulimala at the time, but he said, I was born in a clan where we do not inflict injury to others. But the teacher said, if you don't get the 1,000 fingers, I cannot teach you anymore. So he went to the forest and took up his weapons in the forest and went to the forest and began to kill people. So he kills people and then he cut the fingers of those people. But in the beginning, he did not collect them and keep them in a safe place, so some were taken by the bears and so on. And so later on, he put the fingers on a string and then he wore the fingers as a garland. So from that time on, he came to be known as Angulimala. Now, Anguli means finger, and Mala means a garland. So a person who has a garland of fingers. And it is said that he was very strong, and so nobody could escape him. And he plundered the villagers, and the villagers went to bigger villages to live, and then he planted them again, and so they went to the city. Now the people of the country were afraid of Angulimala, and since many villages were planted and so on, they went to the king and demanded that the king himself go out and catch the bandit. So maybe the king declared that on such a day that he would go out and to catch the thief. Now, the mother of Angulimala heard about the king to go out to catch the bandit, and so she was worried about her son. So she told this to her husband, and father of Angulimala, to go to Angulimala and give this report to Angulimala. But the father refused, because he said, if I go, he will kill me, so I will not go. But, you know, mother's hearts are softer than the heart of the father's. So, at the risk of her own life, she went out to Angulimala. Now, on that day, early morning, Buddha surveyed the world, and she saw Angulimala by his wisdom, and he also saw that Angulimala had acquired the paramis in his past life, and so he Angulimala had the potential to become an arahant. And also he saw that if he did not go on that day, Angulimala would commit killing his own mother, and so would go down to hell. So, after going for alms round in the city, Buddha went out to meet Angulimala alone. Now, the mother was also going to Angulimala, and Buddha was also going to Angulimala. Now, it happens that Angulimala had collected 999 singers, and so only one more to get. So he decided that on that day, whoever comes his way, he would kill. Even if the person is his father or his mother or whoever. So then Buddha went there, and he saw the Buddha. So when he saw the Buddha, he thought, it's strange, because even people come this way in a group of 10, 20, 30, and 40, and they could not escape me, so I killed all of them. Now this monk, this person comes alone, so it is an easy target for him. So he went after the Buddha. But the Buddha, by his supernormal power, wills or made it that he willed in such a way that however fast he Angulimala followed the Buddha, he was not able to reach the Buddha, although Buddha was just walking normally. So he ran after the Buddha, and he was unable to reach the Buddha, and he got tired, and then he thought, at other times, even the swiftest horse, or an elephant, or a chariot cannot escape me. This time, I was unable to reach this man. So he shouted to the Buddha, "Stop, stop." Then the Buddha said, "I have stopped. You stop too." So when he heard this, he thought to himself, this is a monk, and monks should not tell lies. But now he's telling me a lie. While he was going, while he was walking, he said he had stopped. So he talked to the Buddha, "Why do you tell a lie? While you are walking, you said you have stopped." Then the Buddha said, "Angulimala, I have stopped forever, because I abstain from violence towards living beings." So since Buddha did not do any violence towards living beings, Buddha will not be reborn. "But you have no restraint towards living beings, and that is why I have stopped and you have not." That means you have no restraint towards living beings, you are killing living beings, and so you will have to go along with to hat and roof and stakes. And so you are the one who does not stop who is going, and I'm the one who has stopped. So when the Buddha said this, he realized that this person was the Buddha. So he knew, now he knew that this was the Buddha, and he was pleased with what the Buddha talked to him. And so he said, I will refrain from harming living beings forever. And so he threw his weapon, swords and other weapons, and bowed down to the Buddha and asked the Buddha to give him ordination. And the Buddha said, come monk. So when Buddha said, come monk, he was transformed into a monk. So Angulimala became a monk in the forest, but he did not get enlightenment there. So Buddha went back to his monastery in Savatthi, taking Angulimala with him. Now, King Kosala went out of the city to catch Angulimala, and the king was also afraid of Angulimala, because Angulimala was so famous and said to be so cruel that he thought he might be killed by Angulimala. So he thought to himself, before going to catch this bandit, I will go and see the Buddha. So he went to the monastery and paid homage to the Buddha. And the Buddha asked him why he came at such an hour. It was a little late. Then he said, Bandi, there is a bandit called Angulimala, and he had planted many villages and killed many people. And so now I have come out of the city with 500 of my men to catch him. Then the Buddha said, Your Majesty, if Angulimala has become shaved his head and mustache and become a monk and behaving well with good conduct, what would you do to him? Then he said, Bhante, if he has become a monk and well behaved and having good conduct, then I would pay homage to him and invite him with full requisites. But Bhante, how can such an immoral person become tamed and become a monk and well behaving? Then Buddha raised his right arm and pointing to Angulimala and said, Your Majesty, this is Angulimala. So when the king saw Angulimala, he was frightened. So the Buddha said to him, Your Majesty, don't be afraid. No harm can come to you from Angulimala now. And so he went to Angulimala and greeted him and asked about his family, and then invited him with food and clothing. But Angulimala said, I have enough clothes, and so I don't need any more. And so he was pleased, and he praised the Buddha for being able to tame Angulimala without a force or weapon. He said, Bhante, we ourselves could not tame him with force and weapon, but you have tamed him without force or weapons. And so after saying this, he excused himself and returned to his palace. Now one day, Angulimala went out for alms in the city. And in the city, he saw a woman suffering because she could not give birth to the child. So when he saw a woman suffering, he was moved. Now he had changed greatly. While he was a bandit, he had no compassion for anybody. So even though people will implore him not to kill them, he just killed them. But now that he has become a monk and he had given up violence altogether, his heart was moved by just seeing a woman suffering. So we went back to the monastery and then went to the Buddha, and he said, Bhante, beings are afflicted by suffering, beings are afflicted by suffering. Now Buddha knew what he had seen, and so Buddha said, Angulimala, in that case, you go back to that woman and say this as a utterance of truth to relieve her of suffering. And so Buddha gave him a formula, and that formula reads like this: Sister, since I was born, I do not recall that I have ever intentionally deprived a living being of life. By this truth, may you be well, and may the child and the worm be well. So when Buddha gave this formula to him, he said, Bhante, I would be deliberately lying because I have killed so many beings. And the Buddha said, what I meant by that here is not your death as a human being, but what I meant is your death as a monk, your death as in the lineage of noble persons. But if your conscience is not clear, then say this. And then Buddha gave him another formula. And in that formula, Buddha said, since I was born with the noble birth, that means since I became a monk. So that in that case, there was no telling a lie, and he did not kill any living being ever since he became a monk. So he learned this, and then he went to the woman, and then they put a curtain between him and the woman, and then he sat down there and recited this. Sister, since I was born with the noble birth, I did not recall that I have ever intentionally deprived a living being of life. And by this truth, may you be well, and may the child and the woman be well. And immediately after he said this, it is said that the woman gave birth to a child with comfort. Now, Buddha gave Angulimala this formula, this utterance of truth to be used as a charm, because he wanted to help Angulimala. Now, when Angulimala went for alms, people saw him and they were afraid of him. And so many people ran away or shut the doors of their houses, and people would not give him anything. And so he did not get enough food. And so when he did not get enough food, it was difficult for him to practice meditation. And also, since he had killed so many people, when he sat down and practiced meditation, the visions of these people came back to him. They were imploring him not to kill them, or crying and so on. And so he saw these visions, and he had to get up and go away. So now, when this formula was given, and he recited this formula for the delivery of a child, and people would like him. Although he was a bandit and cruel before, now he had compassion for people, and he was doing something good for the people, and so people would like him and think of giving him food and so on. And also when Guru Jyoti Swamina that since I was born with the noble birth, he would be able to avoid those visions. Because it was true that since he became a monk, he did not kill any living being. And so it would help him to forget his past misdeeds and enable him to practice meditation. These two reasons Buddha gave him this formula. So Angulimala got enough food for him, and he was able to forget about his past misdeeds, and so he was able to practice meditation, and he practiced meditation, and he became an arahant. Now, after he became an arahant, he went out for alms as usual, but sometimes a rock thrown by somebody would hit him, or a stick thrown by somebody, not aimed at him, but thrown by somebody hit him, or a piece of pot or something thrown by somebody hit him. And so he went back to the monastery with blood running from his head, his bow broken, and his robe torn. So when Buddha saw him in this condition, Buddha said, "Be patient," something like that. "Bear it, holy man, bear it. You are experiencing here and now the result of deeds because of which you might have been tortured in hell for many thousands of years." So he bore it and later he was able to live peacefully. Yesterday a visitor came and asked me about Angulimala. He said he was not satisfied that Angulimala did not suffer the results of his unwholesome karma. So I told him he did suffer the results of his unwholesome karma, but those results were suffered while he was alive, before he passed away. Because since he had become an arahant, there was no more rebirth for him, and so he did not suffer his spiritual results in next or in coming lives. But in that very life as Angulimala, he suffered a lot, like having his head injured and so on. Now, there is karma that gives results in this very life, in the life where the karma was formed, and there is karma which gives results in the next existence, and there is karma which gives results in the existence after next. So there are three kinds of karma. Whenever we do a wholesome karma or unwholesome karma, there are always these three kinds. With regard to the second and the third, with regard to the karma that gives results in the next life and karma that gives results in the life after next, Angulimala did not suffer anything because he became an arahant. And so he was able to to escape from this realm of rebirth, and so we have no more rebirth, and so we did not suffer that. But in that very life, he suffered from his head being injured and so on, as a result of the karma which did result in that very life. So he did not escape from the results of his karma totally. Because even as an arahant, people cannot escape from the results of their karma, either good or bad. So he suffered the result of his karma he did in that life. In that very life, he suffered the painful consequences of his karma. So we are not to see that it was not fair that Uncle Mother did not suffer much. Now, Angulimala Soda in our collection contains only the words of utterance of truth. Now, in the introductory verses, it is said that even the water with which the feet of one who recites this protective soda is washed destroys all calamities. Now, it is said that they made a seat on the very spot where the Venerable Angulimala recited this utterance of truth. And that place came to possess this power to cause the easy delivery. And it is said that even if some animals that could not give that easily, and they would bring that animal to that place, and when the animal was put on that place, then she gave that to the child easily. And if they could not get the animal there, then they would pour water on the feet, and then take the water and then pour that water on the head of the animal, and then she gave that easily. So it is said in here that even the water with which the feet of one who recites this protective soda is washed destroys all calamities. So not only easy delivery, but it destroys all calamities. This soda is especially popular with expectant mothers. So in our countries, expectant mothers would invite monks and have them chant this Veda and listen to this Veda. And some even learn this Veda, it's a very short one, learn this Veda and chant themselves also. And when they listen to this chanting with confidence, I think it is effective. Before I came to this country, I thought that women in the Western countries would not believe in it. But after I came here, there were some Western women who requested us to chant this to them. And so we did, and maybe it's a coincidence, but they gave back the children easily. Now, among my students, there is a Catholic couple. So they lived not far from my monastery in Delhi City, and later they moved to Concord. So when they moved to Concord, I told them that there is a tradition in our country to bless the house whenever they move to a new place. And so I would like to do that if they have no objection. And they said they would be honored if I did that. And so we went there and they bless the house. I mean, they do the chanting, some of the chanting from this collection. And we saw that the woman was at that time pregnant. And so we chanted the Anguli Manasota also and told her that we did that for her. After about 2 or 3 months, she came and we just chanted it. But now she was asking me to do the chanting for her. So I did that, and later, so when she gave birth to the child, she, her husband reported to us that all went well, and the mother was very comfortable, and everything was done in about 2 hours. So, if you listen to the chanting with confidence, I think it is effective. Okay, that is Angulimala Parida, the ninth in this collection. So the next, the tenth, is called Bodhyanga Sutta. Now Bodhyanga means factors of enlightenment. You may be familiar with the factors of enlightenment. Now there are 7 factors of enlightenment. And this, the Parida in this collection is a restatement in the verse form of 3 short discourses in the Sanlutta Nikaya. It is said that at one time Buddha was living in Rajagaha. And at the time, the Venerable Mahakasapa was greatly sick. And Buddha went to him and asked him whether his sickness decreased. And then he said, no, it doesn't decrease, but it's increasing. So Buddha preached to him the 7 factors of enlightenment. He listened to the preaching and he got free from sickness. But another time, the Venerable Mahamoggallana was sick again. Then Buddha went to him and there preached the 7 factors of enlightenment, and also Moggallana got free from the sickness. But another time, Buddha himself got sick, and then the sickness was increasing. And so Buddha had his disciple, Junda by name, recite the 7 factors of enlightenment to him. And Buddha, listening to his own teaching, uttered by his disciple, and also after the recitation, Buddha got free from the sickness. And so the three noble persons got free from disease by listening to the preaching of 7 factors of enlightenment. And In the last verse of this sutta, it is said that the diseases of these 3 great sages that were eradicated reached the stage of never occurring again, like the mental defilements eradicated by the path. So when a person becomes enlightened and he eradicates mental defilements, and the mental defilements, once eradicated, will never arise again in their mind. like being another defilement, you know, dictated by thought or by enlightenment, these diseases are eradicated and they never occur to them again. So it is a total cure of the disease by just listening to the preaching of seven factors of enlightenment. Now the commentary explains how the sickness was removed by listening to the seven factors of enlightenment, especially with Mahakasapa. Now Mahakasapa became an arahant 7 days after his becoming a monk. So when he became an arahant, he experienced these seven factors of enlightenment to perfection. When a person becomes an arahant, and the seven factors of enlightenment, eight factors of path, they became perfect. So when he heard the seven factors of enlightenment again from the Buddha, he was very joyful. He may be thinking that, oh, these seven factors of enlightenment I have experienced fully when I became an arahant, and now I am hearing these seven factors of enlightenment. And at the same time, he may be experiencing these seven factors of enlightenment in his mind. So when he experienced these factors of enlightenment in his mind becomes joyful. And when the mind is joyful, then it produces good material properties. And so with the growth of good material properties, the disease properties are defeated. So the removal of sickness is possible by listening to the preaching, not just by listening actually, by having by experiencing these seven factors of enlightenment again in their minds. These seven are called factors of enlightenment, the seven mental states. They are called factors of enlightenment because they arise at the moment of enlightenment, and also they lead to enlightenment. These seven factors, some of these seven factors you already find in the eight factors of path, and some of them in the five faculties that we talked about last night. Now these seven are the first, mindfulness. So you already met mindfulness in the component of meditation for last night. And also mindfulness is the right mindfulness among the eight factors of path. And then the second one is called investigation of Dhamma. Investigation of Dhamma really means clear understanding of the Dhamma. So that means understanding of wisdom. And then really effort. You have met effort. And then PD, rapture. And then tranquility. And then concentration. And then equanimity. So among seven, mindfulness is, you are already familiar with mindfulness, and then investigation of Dhamma as clear comprehension of Dhamma, and energy effort, concentration. So, the those that are new are peace, tranquility, and equanimity. When we practice meditation, these peace and pasadi may or may not be arising in your mind. But when you get good concentration, you also experience what is called tranquility of both body and mind. And the last one is called equanimity. So equanimity is not a feeling. It is the mind. How should I say that? Not concerned about to be mindful or to understand things. It is for example, say you are running a machine. So in the beginning, then you have to do this or that to the machine so that it runs smoothly. So you don't have to press one button here or do something there. Then when the machine is running smoothly, then you don't have to make effort for it to run smoothly. So you see something like, what do you call that? Equanimity about the running of the machine. So in the same way, when you have good concentration and you don't have to make much effort, but it comes as though by itself, then you don't have to make effort to be mindful, but mindfulness is there. So that kind of thing is called equanimity here. So that equanimity becomes evident or prominent when yogis reach the stage of the equanimity about formation. So when they reach that stage, they don't have to make effort to be mindful, to have good concentration, but concentration comes as though by itself. So these mental states the yogi experiences when he practices vipassana meditation, and these factors of enlightenment come to perfection when a yogi reaches enlightenment. So these factors are called, and these mental states are called factors of enlightenment here. So in some places we need to call factors of path, or by some other names. So we know that listening to the chanting of seven factors of enlightenment, and also the practice of seven factors of enlightenment can lead us to remove sickness and illness. So when people know about this, then they want monks or other people to chant the seven factors, the discourse on seven factors of enlightenment when they are sick. So people are always trying to find an easy way. Monks are often requested to chant Bodhyanga Sutta when the people are sick. And monks have to do that. But if people listen to the discourse with joy, and if they have meditated before and they have experienced some of these factors, and they try to experience those factors when listening to the chanting, having the chanting is effective. So, by listening to the chanting of the seven chakras of enlightenment and by experiencing at least some of them, it can be effective. Okay, we finished 10 sutras now. So only one more and we'll do it tomorrow. Now, about the practice, I'll continue my explanation. So, we dwell contemplating, practicing body contemplation on the body, ardent, clearly comprehending and mindful, removing covetousness and greed in the world. Now, I told you yesterday that you have to have these four mental states working together and harmoniously. So that is, they are the components of the practice. Now by the last phrase, removing covetousness and greed in the world, Buddha showed what are removed by the practice of meditation, what are removed by the harmoniously working of these four factors. Now, when you are mindful of an object and you see you have clear comprehension of the object, then you do not have attachment for that object, or you do not have aversion towards that object. So avoiding attachment or aversion is what is here called removal of attachment and aversion, or covetousness and grief. So by covetousness, we mean all forms of attachment. Attachment, craving, desire, lust, and so on. And by grief, we mean all forms of aversion or ill will. So anger, hate, depression, frustration, and also fear. Now, when it doesn't really practice, and have the other four factors working together, he is able to avoid both attachment and aversion to the object. So while he is watching, or while he is mindful of the object, then at the same time he is suddenly removing. That means he is preventing the mental defilements from arising with regard to that object. And that is why it is translated as removing covetousness and grief in the world. In many English translations, it is translated as having removed, or say having abandoned covetousness and grief in the world, or having overcome covetousness and grief in the world. Now, I think having removed or having overcome is not so correct. Because if we have removed, if we have overcome covetousness and grief, we don't need to practice Satipatthana. Because the practice of Satipatthana is to avoid, or say to remove covetousness and grief. If we have done it, we don't need to practice meditation. So we must understand that this to mean not after removing, but at the same time we are removing. So when we pay attention to this, or we do not have attachment to this, we do not have aversion to this, and so we are removing, or we are avoiding, we are preventing them from arising at the same time when we are mindful of the object. The commentary says here that the removal is by two kinds of removal. For simplicity's sake, let us call them momentary removal and temporary removal. Now, momentary removal means the mental defilements are removed or avoided only at the moment you are watching. Now, at the moment of watching, at the moment of mindfulness, they cannot come in, and so they are removed. But you stop meditating, and you stop mindfulness, and then they may come in. So that kind of removal is called momentary removal. In the language of the books, it is called, let me see, removing a bad quality by its opposite good quality. That is the first one. And the second one is temporary suppression or removal. So only when you are watching, only when you are mindful, the mental defilements do not arise. So the moment you lose mindfulness, they come in, they arise. And so that kind of removal is called momentary removal. But if you have experience of momentary removal, a strong experience of momentary removal, then you will find that you can keep them from coming back, even with regard to those that are not observed, or even when you are not mindful. Now, with regard to the objects you observe or you are mindful of, you are able to avoid mental defilements. With the force of removing or avoiding mental defilements with regard to the objects you observe, you are able to avoid mental defilements even with regard to those that you do not observe, that you are not mindful of. So that kind of removal is called temporary removal. Sometimes you watch this object and you are able to remove, you are able to avoid mental defilements regarding this. But with the force of that, you are able to avoid mental defilements with another object which you do not observe. So that kind of avoidance of mental defilements is called temporary removal. So when you have that temporary removal, you may think that these mental defilements will not come to you anymore. But that is not the case. So after some time, maybe a longer period of time, then they will come back. So here, removing covetousness and peace in the world should be understood that the removal is by these two kinds of removal. And the commentary further explains that this phrase shows the skill of a meditator, the ability of a meditator, or maybe achievement of a meditator. That means you take an object and you watch it, and you are able to avoid attachment to it. But when you are able to avoid attachment to it, you see the object as it is. So you do not add anything unreal onto the object. Now, the object is impermanent. But if you think it is permanent, then you have attachment to it. So when you have attachment to it, you are actually adding something unreal onto what is real. That is what we normally do. And also, when you are able to avoid grief, that means aversion. When you are able to avoid aversion towards this object, that means, again, you see it as it is. And you do not take something real from this object. Now, what is real is this is impermanent. But you do not like it. So there is dislike about it, and when you do not like it, you want to take it away. You want to throw it away, and then instead you want to put something real onto it. So this shows the removing covetousness and grief in the world shows that when a yogi really has a good concentration, then he is able to take the object as it is without any addition of his own. This is a great achievement of yogis. It is not easy, because in our daily life, we are taught to be taught to judge things. We are taught to see things as beautiful and so on. So when a yogi really concentrates on the object, and he comes to see it as it is, and so he does not add anything unreal onto the object, and he does not take anything real away from the object. So the object becomes just as it is. And that is said to be the achievement of the yogi. So now we understand how much meaning is contained in this short sentence. Ardent, clearly comprehending, mindful, and removing covetousness and grief in the world, and how it is difficult to experience this message fully. So without trying, without making effort, we cannot even come near to it. And so we need to make effort so that we are mindful and our minds become concentrated, and we see things truly as they are. So when we see things as they are, then we are able to avoid adding something unreal onto the object and taking something real out of the object. So when you understand the first sentence with regard to body, you understand the other three sentences with regard to feeling, consciousness, and Dhamma objects. Now, somewhat about Dhamma objects. People want to know what Dhamma objects are. The word Dhamma here cannot be translated. However much you try to translate it, you will not get it fairly correct. So we just keep let it untranslated. Now, Dhamma can mean many things. Discourse of the Four Foundations of Mindfulness. If you read the discourse, you will easily understand what Dhamma means. First, Kaya, the body. So the body means the physical body and the breath and postures and activities of the body. And then feeling, breath and feeling, unpleasant feeling and so on. And then mind or consciousness, the consciousness accompanied by love or hate or ignorance and so on. And then when it comes to Dhamma, Dhamma contemplation, Buddha mentioned five hindrances, five aggregates of clinging, and 12 bases, and then 7 factors of enlightenment, and then 4 noble truths. So all these are called Dhamma. So if you are mindful of one of these, then you are doing the Dhamma contemplation. So, for example, when you are mindful of your anger, then you are doing Dhamma contemplation. But when you say angry, 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 you may be doing the consciousness contemplation. Because angry means my mind is accompanied by anger. But when you pinpoint on anger itself, then you are doing the contemplation on the mental hindrance. The second of the mental hindrances is